Welcome back. Today we are focusing on putting Seder into our Seder. So hopefully this will be a shiur where we can take out something, we can take home something, and whether it be home, whether it be with family, wherever it's going to be, let's try to grow through the process, share through the process, live through the process, or some ideas. I want to just first of all thank the sponsors to Emechi and Abe Zerik, who are sponsoring the shiur this morning for her mother's yard site, Mrs. Pearl Rosenblum, Panina Perel Bas Reb Yaakov HaKohen, I've just started the biography of her father, Rabbi Rosenblum. So there's an incredible history, a part of the American Jewish history and the Hirschian history of the Mishpacha. Mr. Shem Shabbi Lelu Nishmasam. We also want to thank Lisa Friedman, who's sponsoring on two accounts for Ira, for Yisrael Nassanel Ben Shlomo, somebody who impacted all of our lives in this room, somebody who we deeply remember. We also remember that it was his, he got through the first 2 days of Pesach to be with the Mishpacha. That was around specifically now, and also for Lisa's mother-in-law, Mrs. Miriam Friedman, Miriam Bas Nassanel, and it's of course a pleasure to have Miriam here. So the namesake continues. It should be in Nishmasai and in Nishmasa, as we continue to always be impacted by Ira and his family. Also, today's shiur is sponsored by Mark Berlin. This is the first yard site of Mrs. Judith Berlin, his mother Yehudis Bas Yitzchak, being there at the Leviah a year ago. I do remember just what an incredibly worldly and cultured individual she was. What a breath of optimism and fresh air she was to the family and to those around her. And a tremendous loss for him, for the entire Mishpacha. And Emes Hashem, he should find continued nechama this coming year. Without much further ado, let's start. We've got a lot ahead of us. I'm so excited about the shiur. In fact, I added an extra idea just this morning, 5 minutes before shiur. So that's how excited I am about this. There's more involved than even meets us. So let's start. Here we go. So what I decided to do is rather than just going through and sort of, you know, wading through the ocean of this particular topic and deciding where I felt was interesting, I said let's try to focus this year on specific topics. The specific topic is any actions. Okay, so we're going to try to focus on the actions in the Seder. So we've done a lot in the past years, texts, greater themes, structure, superstructure. This year we're going to talk about, we're going to learn a little bit about some of the actions in the Seder and how they are relevant. So let's start at the very beginning. Starting with Karpas. So here's the Haggadah. It tells us, if we open up our regular Haggadah, it says, Tovlim Karpas Pachas Mikazayas B'mei Melach Umvarchim. So we dip the Karpas, and yes, there's a debate about what it is. My son's 6-year-old class, they had a vote whether it would be parsley or potato, and he said that he was outvoted with parsley, but he still prefers the potato. So there are different opinions as to what it is. Why is more the relevant question? Why is it that we're doing this whole business? Why are we dipping these hors d'oeuvres? Not so simple. So interestingly enough, a lot of it is actually attributed back to the following. Let's see if we can actually get some text over here. There must be a way to get it. There we go. So the Torah says the following. In Perek Shmois Vayavidu, So the Torah tells us that Egypt enslaved us with what is called parech. Parech literally means what? That's the way we translate it usually is, they enslaved us with hard work. And it's interesting because what is famously known is that if you take the word parech itself, right, there is a certain sense, the karpas is sort of hidden in that word. You look at the word perech, it's chof, resh, pei, right? Which is essentially karpas, right? So if you look at hard work backwards, you have karpas in there. And that kind of relates to the fact that we're dipping it in the salt water, right? There's the tears, there's the bitterness. But it must be a little more than that, you know, because, you know, what happens if you're not linguistically inclined, right? You know, you're going to naturally see that. That's going to be your first assumption as to what's going on. Not so simple. So, interestingly enough, the Gemara says the following. The Gemara says that it might not be that Perach actually means hard labor.
The Gemara says, quoting the Gemara in Sota on Yud Aleph of Beis, it says, Rabbi Eliezer Amar Beperach, Beperach. It actually is a combination of two words, which means with a soft mouth. With a soft mouth. Interesting. What does that mean, a soft mouth? So the Medrash elaborates on this and says that, how is it that you get an entire nation of people to be enslaved? I mean, it just, you know, all you need is some rational human being to say, this is not for me, and that's the end of it. Like, you know, just to get people to do things. This is there before the age of social media. Well, how do you do this? So the Egyptians understood something very canny about the nation of Israel. By the way, they weren't even the nation of Israel. We'll call them Hebrews at this point. They don't even have a national identity as Israelites, and they're certainly not Jews, right? So they understood something interesting about the Hebrews, and that is that they called a national work week. And they said, all Egyptians, hear ye, hear ye. Here saith the king, O Pharaoh, who is going to say that all national citizens of Egypt should go to work in the fields. And that's what happened. And guess who led the charge? Naturally, the Hebrews, right? Because that's what we do. And slowly what happened was, after that week, then there were certain like adjustments as to the work law. And slowly the Egyptians started receding from it. And guess who remained? The Hebrews remained. And that's how it started. That's how the whole business began. And you think about that, when we think about what that actually means, that means to say was, we in a certain sense were our own worst enemy. Because it was our willingness, our patriotism to the society, which our mother society, which we wanting to prove to those around us that we were so Egyptian that we weren't anyway connected to the foreign nation that we'd come from, that ultimately we became slaves through that same process. We enslaved ourselves by biting that bait that they put out for us. And if you think back to history, how many times and in how many short generations in every country, in every mother country that we've been, have we been trying to prove to that country that we're much more them than they are themselves? Think about it. You know, this is a chaplain in the German army in World War I. These are the Jewish soldiers. They're lighting Friday night candles in the Great War. In World War I, there were Jews who came out with the Iron Cross in World War I. Now, there's nothing wrong with serving Germany, but just remember how well it served us. Right? Meaning to say, we were the best of every society. Did the society remember us when they killed us or kicked us out or pogroms? No, they didn't. They didn't worry about that. It started in Egypt. Says Rabbi Benjamin Blech in his Haggadah, it actually came out just a year ago, really a beautiful Haggadah. I just bought some of the Haggadahs I brought. So it's called... It's called Redemption, Then and Now. So for those who are interested in seeing it, he has a very fascinating piece. And he says, this is why the word karpas, which reminds us of this threat, assumes such a prominent place in the Seder. And that's why its meaning is hinted by reading it backwards. Because this truth can never be understood at the time it occurs, but only when viewed with wisdom of hindsight, in retrospect. Looking backwards, we can understand how we were foolishly misled into Egypt, in Egypt, as well as all other countries, in which we assumed that greater patriotism guaranteed our survival. Interesting enough, you go back to 1944, Stephen Wise, head of the AJC, the most powerful Jew in America at the time, when it came to a march on Washington about bombing the tracks to Auschwitz, he suggested pacifism. We don't want to upset the government. He told that he actually advised the government to ignore the rabbis marching on Washington who are requesting to bomb the tracks to Auschwitz. Why? Because American came before Jewish. There's a story, and this I mentioned yesterday, but it's such a powerful story. Golda Meir. This is a famous story about Henry Kissinger and Golda Meir. When the Israeli Prime Minister chided the American Secretary of State to remember his Jewish origins, he replied, Mrs. Meir, I'm an American Jew, an American first. Mr. Kissinger, Golda responded. Here we read backwards. And here, too, the word karpas, we're reminded to read in reverse direction as well. So sometimes we need to think to ourselves, you know, for all the great achievements that we have and the greatest echelons in society that we've risen to, just remember, we did that in Egypt too. And that was our downfall. We need to retain that balance where we still have that connection to our core identity, or we need to work out where our core identity lies. That's the question that Karpas has. Very, very powerful point. Idea number one. Let's move on to the next action item, which is, Halach ba'anya. Oh, I apologize. I think actually we're going to do it this way around. Let's do yachatz first, okay? Because yachatz actually comes beforehand. Yachatz. So we break the matzahs. Breaking the matzahs. The instructions in the Haggadah tells us, Bala ba'yis yivtza es ha-matzah im tza'is v'shtayim u'metzapim es ha-chatzi ha-gadol avikomen. So you break it in two, you measure it up, and the bigger one goes away for avikomen. We'll get back to avikomen maybe a little bit later.
Why the middle matzah? Why are you breaking it in half? Why is all this business? And everybody says, Kedei sheyishado hatinagos. So everybody should, so the kids should ask. So what do you answer them? What exactly do you answer them? There has to be an answer to some of these questions. So there, I saw an interesting insight which was brought down in a separate Haggadah. This is called the historical Haggadah, if anybody has a chance. Rabbi Nachman Cohen. Rabbi Nachman Cohen is a researcher who still works at YU. You have a chance to meet him. He's doing incredible research. He's putting out volume upon volume of ideas. And this is his Haggadah. When I was working in YU, he very kindly gave me a copy. And he says that he suggests a very interesting thing. He quotes the Gemara. This is a Gemara which I assume many of us have heard, but I never heard it in the connection of the Haggadah at all. Here's what the Gemara itself says. I put the translation and the actual text of it itself. So let's just, I want to just actually just read it out loud. So here's what the Gemara says. Here is what the Gemara says. This is the Gemara in Shabbos Daf Pei Tesam Beis. It says, Amar Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmeni, Amar Rabbi Yochanan. Ma'adich says, there's a question. What is this pasuk which says, Ki ato avinu, ki avram lo yadanu, v'yisrael lo akirenu, ato Hashem avinu, go aleinu, me'alom shimcha. So the pasuk seems to say that Avram forgets us, Yisrael sold us down the river, and Hashem, because of you, you're going to save us. Okay, so what's this referring to? What's this pasuk actually referring to? So the Gemara tells us, I mean, this story is so shocking that we're about to hear. If you hadn't seen this in print, it would have been heresy if we'd made it up ourselves. Okay, so here's what the story says. Lastly, Lava, in the future, Yomar LaKadosh Baruch Hu LaAvram, Bonecha Chatuli. So Hashem comes to Avram and says, your children sinned to me. What should I do? Amar Lefonav, Ribono Shel Olam, Yimach Al Kiddush Hashemecha. Avram looks at the tables, looks at the charts, and he says, you know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, you're 100% right. There's nothing I can do. You know what the best opportunity you have is? Get rid of them, but at least get rid of them, Al Kiddush Shemecha, and that'll rectify the scales of what they've done through the course of Jewish history. Okay. Says Hashem, you know what? Maybe Avram doesn't understand so well. Yeah, you know, his children, you know, Yishmael had a little bit of a teenage years experience, but he came back in the end. Right, but Yaakov, you know, had a tough time bringing up children. Right, he really had a tough time. So maybe Yaakov will be more empathetic to the cause. So what does he do? He says, maybe he will ask Rachamim for them. He says, your son sinned. Yaakov says, you know, you got a very convincing case. That's it. I'm sorry. So Hashem says the grandfathers don't have good advice. There's no good word from the grandchildren. So he comes to Yitzchak, the middle one. Oh, Nebuch, Yitzchak, he was always very quiet, right? Yitzchak doesn't have so much about him in the Torah. Is there, you know, we hear a lot about Avram Avinu, we hear a lot about Yaakov. Okay, maybe, you know, who knows? Maybe Yitzchak will have something to say. So he comes over to Yitzchak. And it's like the husband who says, you know, honey, your daughter just threw the dessert on the kitchen floor. And so she says, my daughter? Right? So Yitzchak says, my children, not your children, Hashem? Really? That's the way it works? He says, B'sharshek dimo lefonecha nasev nishma karasim b'ni b'chari akshal b'nai v'la b'necha. When they said Nasir Nishma at Har Sinai, you call them your firstborn. Now my son, now you're shunting the blame to me, Yitzchak. So now Yitzchak gets technical. And he says, we're going to make a deal. Hashem, we'll cut a deal together. Here we go. Kama Chatu. Listen, how much could they sin? Kama Shanosh Ashalam. Let's take an average lifespan of a human being. Shivim Shana. Right, 70 years. And, you know, Baruch Hashem, today we're seeing the average increase. But, you know, up till very recently, this is the, and still in many places, Shivim Shana. Dal Esrin Dolei Anashra Alayu. We know that to the first 20 years, a person isn't really culpable for punishments, for whatever that means, and how that accumulates afterwards. Okay, so let's discredit the first 20. Pashu Luchamshin. So there's 50 left. Okay. Dal Chofei Bidelei Yusso. So take away 25 of them because of nights. Now remember, when there's no electricity, what happens when the lights go out is you go to sleep. Today, I'm not so sure, you know, when the lights go, you know, when it gets dark outside, I'm not so sure we're so safe. Right? He says, but however, Dal Tarti Sari Upalgo, Datsaluyu Umechel Dubesa Kisa. So take another half of those. Take 25 of those, which are involved with, you know, davening, eating, going to the restroom. Partial or entirety, sorry. You know what there is? If you have it down, you have 12 and a half. See, Yitzchak says, Hashem, if you're willing to just, look, Nebuch. Look how much is left in a person's life to sin. 12 and a half years, that's really, you know, I mean, that's full-time sinning. Right, so he says, if you can say, be sovel that, if you can bear that, that's wonderful. If not, you know what we'll do is we'll cut a deal. On my merit, on my credit, which means to say that whether Yitzchak has credit for this or he's going to be going to overdraft for this, he says, I'll take half of it. I mean, and you think about it for a second, you know, when you talk about the sacrifice of Yitzchak, the sacrifice of Yitzchak wasn't just up on Har Moriah. The sacrifice of Yitzchak was a continuing self-sacrifice for the community, for his children. That's what it meant. Avram, Yaakov weren't interested. Yitzchak was. So Rav Nachum Cohen points out, well, it's interesting, because if you look at the matzos have different symbolisms. Cohen, Levi, Yisrael, there's all the different symbolisms. One of them is Avram, Yitzchak, Yaakov. Which matzah do we break? The middle matzah. Why would we break it in half? Because, what did Yitzchak say? Let's split it up. I'll bear the brunt of that. Think about the sacrifice of what that actually meant. That's potentially what's happening over here. When you think about this, think about moments in our lives that we've made sacrifices for people when there was no interest, there was no end goal. Think about people from the previous generation who made sacrifices which we could not comprehend on the sake of others when there's not something to gain. That's what is happening in the middle of Matzah here. Let's go back to Halach Ma'aniyah for a second. This is not backwards, but backwards in the slide, but it's the next section in the Haggadah. So that we're told that Megaleh Samatzos Samagbiyah Saka'ara V'Omer B'Kol Ram. So what you do is you open up the Matzos and you say to everybody else, Halach Ma'aniyah De'achla Avar Sana De'ar Mitzrayim. This is the poor man's bread that was eaten in Egypt. Kol Dichvin Yeseh V'Yechal. Anybody who wants, please come and eat. Anybody welcome in now? Forget the question about how it is that we're inviting people right now. You know, it's kind of like, you know, sending an invitation after the wedding. You know, so like, that's not what's happening over here. That's not what we're going to focus on. But there's another question at hand. And that is a very basic question. Simple question here. Here you're inviting guests in. And you want to really impress your guests. So what do you give them? You give them poor man's bread. We're not even like disguising that fact. We're not saying, you know, come and have a meal. We say, here you go, have this brittle cardboard. You know, it's like, you know, like what kind of guests are you expecting to impress with that, right? Meaning, like, let's talk about the Korban Pesach, right? Let's maybe even the Charoses, right? But the Halach Ma'aniyah, that's your 5-star service. That's what it means to be a host. Very strange, right? Never thought about that, right? It's like it's a strange way to enter the Seder. So, interestingly enough, this is something I heard once from Jonathan Sachs. I didn't see it in print, but I saw I heard him quote it a little while back. Let's see if we can get it actually in the quote. Yeah. There's a section in a book called. Let's see if it's going to work. It looks like Mac is a little bit behind Microsoft when it comes to these things. Here we go. Let's see if it arrives. There's a book called If This Is a Man by Primo Levi. So Primo Levi was, of course, a Holocaust survivor, and he wrote many different accounts, some of them autobiographical, some of them projected experiences. There's some very terrifying experiences to write to when you this is not bedtime reading to read Primo Levi. So he has a book called If This Is a Man, and he has a description now of the end of the redemption from the concentration camps. This is his description. And it's the most remarkable thing because it really is a pirush on the Haggadah in a certain sense. Here's what he says. When the broken window was repaired and the stove began to spread its heat, something seemed to relax in everyone. Remember, the Germans have left. They're now in this broken camp. They have nobody to fend for themselves. There's no food. At this moment, Torowski, a Franco-Pole 23 with typhus, proposed to the others that each of them offer a slice of bread to us three, who had been working, and so it was agreed. Only a day before, a similar event would have been inconceivable. The law of the lager said, eat your own bread, and if you can, that of your neighbor, and left no room for gratitude. It really meant that the lager was dead. By the way, when you read Knight, when you read Elie Wiesel, there was a conversation he has with a fellow as his father's in the bunk below him, dying. So there's a fellow who comes over to him and says, take his bread. Right, take his bread. Your life is worth more than his. And he refused to do that. He was trying to nurse his father, who was dying slowly, back to health. And the man laughed at him. He says, you'll see. It wasn't worth the soup and bread that you gave him. Because meaning, in a certain sense, the self-centeredness of survival is so great. What Prime Levi is saying is you could not share.
It was the first human gesture that occurred among us. I believe that that moment can be dated as the beginning of the change in which we had no longer died slowly, changed from Haftlinger to men again. Meaning, the moment that a person can offer beyond themselves is the moment that they've now freed themselves from being constricted to self-survival. That's ultimately what we're doing. If you think about the Haggadah saying, is Holach Ma'anya di Achlav Osalimar Mitzrayim, called Difin Yeser Yisach. You know what? We don't have much, but even that not much is worth sharing. That's the greatest expression of freedom. That's the greatest expression of freedom. And like today, Baruch Hashem, if you think about how much we do have, you know, okay, let's try to think about how free we are when we really share it, if that's the benchmark of it. In so many different ways, you know, like, when you just see the way people drive, I mean, it's just on a day-to-day basis, you know, like, how free are we when we have to cut people off every moment of the day because we have to get the one extra second? How free are we? Right? We can have an individual here who has absolutely nothing besides the cloth on their frail shoulders, and they're willing to share the crumbs that they have. That's freedom. That's what real freedom is. The Haggadah starts off by saying, who is free? Who's really free? That's the question that God is begging from us. Let's go a little further. Pouring out the wine. This is just something which I thought on a halachic level is very fascinating. Why is it that when we get to, this is of course, this is what we all keep the kids up for, right? Don't worry, that the Amakos are coming. The song, pull out the cups, let's splash around, right? So the Ramah tells us, this is the Rav Moshe Isserles in codifying Jewish law in Simon Taf Ayin Gimel, Siv Zayin says, V'nagim lizroik ma'at min ha'kos be'etzpo, you throw out a little bit of the cup with your finger. Now, don't get carried away. Lizroik doesn't mean to say, you know, tossing. It means to push a little bit out. He says, K'shemagir l'dam v'eshu simras ha'sham l'chein, K'shemazkir makos tetzach ba'adash ba'achav, V'chlal v'frat ha'kol yudvav pa'amim. He says, the Maril quotes that we do this 16 times. Okay, we do this 16 times. Why? Why are we doing this? Why are we throwing out all this wine all the time? That's the question that's at hand. So famously, I think of the idea that we most famously are aware of is the Yalkut Shimoni. The Yalkut Shimoni says, this is in Parshas Emor, a famous idea which I think, this is what we take home usually. The Yalkut Shimoni is dealing with the fact that we have a discrepancy in Hallel recitation. For the first 5 days of Pesach, or 6 days of Pesach, we say Hallel. The first 2 days of Pesach we say Hallel. Thereafterwards, we say only half Hallel. Why? So the Midrash, the Yalkut Shimoni says, Dovar Achav, Bishvil Shemesu Boya Mitzrim. The Mitzrim died. V'chelat Amoitzo Kol Shiva Simei Achag, Anu Korim Boya Mitzah Halel, Avo Pesach, Ein Anu Korim Mitzah Halel. On Sukkot, we say the full Halel the entire time. On Pesach, no. Ela B'yom Tov Rishon V'leilo. We only say on the first night and first day, and in Chutzar, it's the first 2 days and nights. La Lama Mishum B'nifol Oivecho Al Tisma. U'vikish Loi Al Yagel Libecho.
Don't get happy when your friends are dying. Don't rejoice when your enemies are downtrodden. Don't feel that you now are able to gloat when they're on their way down. So we're talking about the Makos. We're talking about how the entire Egyptian society was crushed. So don't gloat. This is not a moment. We as Jews are not going to gloat on the downfall of society. We've been at the bottom of the heel of every society. We're not going to gloat when this happens. So while we talk about their suffering, we take out a little bit of our full cup. Our cup does not overflow at this point in time. While we're talking about their suffering, that's the most famous idea. However, there are other explanations which I wasn't aware of until very recently. The Mishnah Berurah actually on the Shulchan Aruch says something quite different, altogether different, very different tone altogether. The Mishnah Berurah says, "Be'etzpa, nagim nizroik be'etzpa al shem etzpa Elokim hi." Why? Because of the finger of God. Is that interesting? What's the finger of God representing?
Makos.
It's representing His power as doing the makos. It's not about the Egyptians and our empathizing with their position. It's in a certain sense, we're almost like creating a metaphor for that experience. We're pulling out with the power of our finger, as Hashem had power over Egypt in that way. Not like the Hagos Mamonis says with the small finger. And by the way, if we go around this room, I'm sure we could find many different minhagim. The spoon, the baby finger, there's lots of different options. And the Mishnah Berurah says specifically the index finger. Why? Because that's representing what God did. Okay, now not to disclaim any other minhagim. It just happens to be in this thought process, this is where he's going. He says another option. Why is it 16 drops? Let's clarify. 16 drops is because 10 makos, 10, right? And then we also have Tetzach Adash Ba'achav. There is a tune to that, right? So there's Tetzach Adash Ba'achav, and then there's Dan Va'esis in Rosh Hashan. So there's 16 in total. So the Mishnah Berurah points out, Kabbalistically, Keneged Oisios Yudvav Mishmoy Shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Shehiko Esa Es Paro. It's interesting that apparently the letters Yud and Vav, Hashem's name is made up of a Yud and a Hey and a Vav and a Hey. Apparently the Yud and the Vav of the name are the 16. In a sense, are the 16 which represent Hashem's Nakama, Hashem's vengeance upon Egypt, which is what we're representing in this. So the Mishnah Berurah is talking about a completely different tone altogether. He's not talking about thinking about those poor, devastated Egyptians. He's talking about representing the power of God. So we're doing this over here altogether powerfully. That may also represent the difference in fingers, maybe, as to what's going on. One last thing which I noticed, which is interesting, is that in a woodcut of the Praga Gara, well, should we try that again? No, there we go. Let's try that. You know, we're still getting used to the Mac presentation tools. So okay. Let's see. It's going to go pass us through again. There you go. Okay. So the Praga Gara has a woodcut in which it has a person taking out drops from the cup. And interestingly enough, what it actually says, the quotation on it is, so I'm going to read it to you. The quotation underneath it is this. This is again from 1526. So we're talking about really 400 and a long time ago now, right? It seems to me that this is a. Here we are. The caption of the woodcut makes the same point. It says, "All of the illness which I put on Egypt, I will not put on you." In other words, it's as if to say they should not harm us. There's a promise that Hashem made to us that. When everything Hashem did bad to Egypt will be reflected in the good to us. So Hashem won't do the same things to us. So in a certain sense, what we're symbolizing is all the evil that happened in the Makos, the Dan Va'es, the Rosh Hashanah, and Tetzach Adash Ba'achav, it should reflect well on us. These should be insulations or protections for us that we don't experience the same things. This is kind of in between this Haggadah, this Praga Haggadah, is in between really what the Yalkut Shimon is saying in the Mishnah Berurah. It's not about the vengeance, it's not about the suffering, it's about our protection, which is really the middle course, which is a very different and interesting halachic discussion about this. Let's go a little further. It was moved to Tzofen, to the end of the Haggadah, the hiding of the Afikoman. So, the instructions tell us very clearly, Acha Gemara Su'udah, Echod Subin Kazayis Afikoman. Right, so you take the Kazayis of the Afikoman. You know, at this point in time, the kids are clearly, I'm clearly in control. They have the leverage over the parents, depending on which way it works, who took what, and who hid what. Nonetheless, this is an interesting Haggadah. This is a Haggadah of Rabbi Nachman of Breslov. It's perhaps the most punctuated Haggadah I've noticed. There's lots of exclamation points in it. So here's what he says, and here's an interesting psychological insight over here about the Afikoman, about what's hidden in our lives. So here's what he says. He says, "Holachnu." It's like you can hear this is very expressive, a very emotive description. Here's what he says: "Holachnu leibud." We've gone to destruction. Ulai lifnei shanim satinu mehaderech. For many years, we have maybe erred from the road. We've taken detours. Shomanu leitzos raos. We've listened to bad advice in our lives. Lo ayinu mudaim oz latotzoyes shel tzadenu. We didn't realize the ramifications of our steps, where we're being led to. Our kol tzad hirchik osan yoser v'yoser im kol tzad. But every step we're taking is taking us further and further away from where we really ought to and should and want to be. Im kol ma'aseh shehirchik osan me'ashem hisadnu, hishlachnu chelek minishmosenu. In a certain sense, we're losing ourselves. We're withering away as we move in a direction which is not where we are and deserve to be in our lives. Avata. So what about now? Anu avodim. And sometimes we turn around and we say, it's too dark, it's too cloudy to even return. Where's the way back? He says, Hatzadik. So he gives us two options. Option number one is, we're not going to focus on this as much, but Hatzadik is a righteous person. Remember, in Chassidus, and certainly in this branch of Chassidus, there's an individual who's going to be the guide. So the righteous person, who are made herchek me al ashvilim hamispatchlim shel olam hazem. So he quotes in the Mesillas Yesharim, which describes that this world is like a maze. Like, you know, you have a garden maze, and you go into the hedges, and you're trying to find the center or the other end, and you don't really know what's going on. So what you need to do is, if you really want to cheat, what you need to do is you have somebody who is able to stand on the balcony, which overlooks the backyard of this, you know,
this large garden. And then they're able to say, well, you know, going down that route is clearly a dead end. It doesn't look like it to you, but I can see, because I can see the vast array of what's of the entire maze. So he says, sometimes enough, we need to find people who can tell us how to retrace our steps to be able to find the right direction. Otherwise, we just sit down and we can't go further. He knows how far we've got in our strayings. He sees the pieces of our soul which have been shattered or lost along the way of our perilous journey. To find ourselves. Meaning to say, part of retracing our steps isn't just finding the right way, it's finding the pieces of ourselves which were lost along the way, which were hurt, and have hurt us because we're carrying that burden of pain. And so part of our journey of return is to finding a spiritual guide, is finding somebody who can really help us, who is just a little bit above the garden maze, who can help us find the way back. That's what he's saying. And of course, this is very much a Hasidic idea where you can find somebody, but it's not just Hasidic, there's a lot of truth to this. Finding those people in life who are just a few steps ahead of us or above us. But the second part is what I wanted to focus on. And that is, he says in a very short line, he says, how do we find ourselves back? He says, Afikoman. Who avad lanu? In a certain sense, what he's saying is representation in our Afikoman is there's parts of ourselves, we've broken off parts of ourselves, and might even be a bigger part of our personality, and it's no longer there. And there's something missing from our lives, and we can't find it. So who finds it for us? Isn't it interesting? He says, Ne'elam, lo. It hasn't disappeared. Hayaladim lakhu asai. Hem rak mismastirim asai. The children are hiding that part of us which has long been lost from us, which is that gap in ourselves, which is no longer there. And if you think about this for a moment, he actually elaborates this in a more recent Haggadah. Well, this is actually a student, but it's been elaborated in his name in a more recent Haggadah. And if you think about this, children, right? There's so many aspects of our lives where we calcify and we become adults. Becoming adults is, and I remember hearing this beforehand at Rabbi Binyamin Kamenetsky's funeral, his levaya, just under a year ago. So what's the difference between a young person, a younger man, and an older person? So the younger person is always willing to try, despite the dangers of failure. The thing about that was a description of Rav Kamenetsky, because I mean, like he was in the nursing home, you know, he was in the Grandel, and you know he was trying to find a shidduch for his non-Jewish nurse. There was never a moment in his life he was stopping to like project after project, idea after idea, building after building, institution after institution. That's what it means to be young, is never stopping, never ceasing to try. What happens as we become adults is we realize that when we try enough times, we get burnt. We try enough times, it doesn't work. And then the risk outweighs the curiosity to try. That's what ends up happening as we become adults. And in a certain sense, we lose aspects of who we should or could be. That's really what happens. There's potential of what we would have, let's say 20 years ago, have with that twinkle in our eye, would have tried despite the fact we might have lost something, and that would have been our greatest thing, but we're not willing to do that because it's too dangerous now. We're too dangerous, the vulnerability of self-exposure, the vulnerability financially, whatever it is. You know, that's interesting enough, in one of Malcolm Gladwell's books, Outliers, he talks about they did a longitudinal research about the richest people in the world, in all of world history. I mean, say, you know, comparing currencies, comparing, you know, world economies at the time, to see who the most, and it's interesting, you know, you see Cleopatra backed up to Rockefeller. You know, like, it's interesting, you're like across all of history, who the richest people were. So in the top 20, or the top 50, I think it is, of these people, I believe that 11 of them lived in the late 1800s. Meaning to say they were born in the range of about 10 years in 1840 to 1850 was the age that these, the most rich, the Rockefellers, you know, the Carnegies, right? All the steel, right? So the analysis that he did was, and this is his argument, is that there was a window of opportunity. Following the Civil War, there were these people who were in their late 20s, early 30s. Late 20s was just enough experience to know how to go into business, but not enough family yet for taking risks. There was not yet the taxes that would have crippled their great steel industries and the great rail industries of the time for them to invest. Meaning that this critical point in life where they still had that ability to try without the danger of risking their families. Think about that for a moment.
and how that allowed them to, for that window of time, to be the world's most, well, I wouldn't call successful, but richest people of all times. Now, if we think about that, what we've lost is, what the children are hiding is, that part of us, which sometimes comes out only at the end, where we forget who, what we were and what we could have tried. That's what they're revealing to us. They bring back that to us. There's a book called The Element by Sir Ken Robinson. He was knighted in England and left England, and then he came to LA. As he says, it was a seamless move, as you can imagine. And one of the things he talks about in this book called The Element, which is a very worthwhile read. It's a very interesting book. It's called The Element over here. And what he says is, he talks about how that part of our ability or our charge in education is to be able to allow children to keep experimenting. So he gives an example. He talks about how he's in, the five-year-old class. I love this story. He's in the five-year-old kindergarten. And the teacher's going around, and she says that they are allowed to do free-range drawing. They're allowed to make a picture of anything they want. So she's going around the class, and everybody's doing their, little house and the snowman and the leaves falling and all the different things they're doing. And Susie at the back is sitting there, and every time the teacher comes past, she covers up her work. And so she says, "Susie, can I ask you, what are you drawing?" She says, she looks around, and she says, "It's a secret." She says, "Well, you can tell me. I won't tell anybody else." She says, "I'm drawing God." So she says, "But Susie, nobody knows what God looks like." And she says, "Well, in a few minutes they will." But in a certain sense, what ends up happening, what happens in our lives is we close down that ability to try things, because whether it's an attitude, whether it's the way we look at the children, where it's what society's saying, where it's the focus on STEM, whatever it is, that trying is not worth it, because we know the answers. We know where the end point is, and we don't allow that back. So often is that moment, says Rav Nachman, where we allow that back into our lives, allow what's hidden, the parts of ourselves which were hidden in our lives, to be rediscovered. What an unbelievable insight. What an unbelievable insight. Something to live with. Two more ideas and we'll close this. This is the part which has always puzzled me. This is the end of the Haggadah, as we're getting towards the end of the Haggadah, which is Eliyahu at the door. We pour the cup of Eliyahu, and we go to the door, those who are still vertical, and we say this paragraph of Shvoi Chamos, which, by the way, was a later introduction to the Seder. You won't find this in the Seder as described by the Mishnah, right? The Mishnah has a certain structure. This seems to be a later introduction. Why is it that we're mentioning Eliyahu? Why are we standing by the door this night? Always something which confused me. So there are some interesting thoughts. There are some people who suggest, just interestingly enough, and this is just this for thought. If you go to the Gemara in Arve Pesachim, just on a halachic level, the Gemara talks about there's something what's called zugois, a threat of zugois. Zugois literally means pairs, which means it's a very tough sugya to read through, if anybody's gone through it recently. It talks about how you shouldn't have foods in pairs. Why? Because pairs ultimately welcome in demons. There's a certain darker force in this world which you welcome in when we eat in pairs. Now today, the Gemara says, those who are worried about it should worry about it. Those who don't worry about it, don't worry about it. But the Gemara does suggest, and it asks how it is, that maybe the Arba Kosos are zugos, because they come in pairs, right? The Gemara discusses maybe each one is its own mitzvah, maybe they're independent, maybe they don't relate to one another. But there's an opinion that says no, they're separated from one another, because this one's at the beginning of Maggid, this one's after Maggid, this one's at the beginning of the meal, this one's after the meal. So some of the halachic opinions say that maybe part of the reason is that we have Shvoi Chamos, because we insert a prayer, not just Hallel, we insert a prayer in between the third and the fourth cup to separate them. Interesting thought. Just on a halachic level, take it as you may. But there are other ideas as well. The Maharal says famously in his Haggadah, and it's just very, very, very futuristic, or not futuristic, but very insightful into the future. The Maharal died at the beginning of the 1600s. Just appreciate this. The Maharal says that when we're about to ask for Geula, that Hashem is going to bring us redemption, we should remember that the only person who brings Geula is Eliyahu. We open the door and we remind ourselves that there's not going to be anybody else who's standing at that door. It's interesting because Shabtai Tzvi lived just after the Maharal. 1666 was the apex of Shabtai Tzvi's false messianism. And it was a terrible time for the Jews. We suffered for two centuries following it because of that in many different ways. What is being said over here is the Maharal is suggesting is remember that when we talk about Geula, let's remember the address of Geula. Let's not forget it, which is just an interesting thing. Obviously, at the time, we've suffered from many false messiahs. Maharal is obviously referring to some in the past, but none are more destructive than the ones that followed them. Nonetheless, here's what I got, which I received recently.
called the Shemin HaTov, Rav Bernard Weinberg. Anybody heard the name? So from running young Israel of Brooklyn.
Yes.
Wonderful, wonderful individual. He has a Pirush in Torah called Shemin HaTov. And on the Haggadah, his Haggadah came out, Tavshin Ayin Dalet. So this is a very recent Haggadah. And he really has just very interesting insights. He says something which I had never thought about. This is now a Parshanut kind of a swing on things. He points out that when we're talking about Shvoi Chamos Chal HaGoyim, when Hashem pour thy wrath or thy wrath onto the nations, he points out that if you look at the structure of the Haggadah, we talked about in Maggid where we were slaves and the terrible beginnings we had and how we moved upwards and Hashem saved us, smote them down and brought us out, and then we started saying Hallel. That was before we ate the meal. Now we eat the meal, so we need to pick up from there. So he points out that we're picking up the same strand, which is Hashem, as you are pouring your wrath onto them, carry on in a futuristic way to the future. But he says the following. He goes on, he says, yeah, Dekoidem Hayatzia, five lines in. He says, because before you leave, yeah, Games Agoy Asher Yavoidu Dana Noichi. The nation who enslaves you is going to be judged by me. There is going to be justice at the end of the day. Barak La'acha Shadana Roshoi Hama'avidim Es Israel, Az Yeh Va'acharekein Yetzu Birchush Gadol. You can only really get to the point of real Yetzias Mitzrayim once there's been a justice. And we think about the centuries of lack of justice in our history. The unjustified or the unpunished blood of our brothers, sisters who have died throughout the centuries. He says only after that, we only get real redemption when that comes to exactitude. By the way, who's doing the judging? God. Okay, just to be clear on that. Okay, that's when we finish the Haggadah. He says, who's referring to? Behind Paroi Harasha. She Omar, Loyadati es Hashem. Vashe rat, Vashe bishim koloi koro, Hainu de Omar Paro, Miashem, Asher Eshma bekoloi.
So who are we referring to? He says, Paro is the paradigm of the person who we're trying to eradicate. Isn't this interesting? Shvach HaMoscha ultimately is actually quoting the pasuk that Paro himself said. Do we ever think about that? That's exactly what Paro did. He wasn't willing to look at Hashem. So we start off by saying, HaKadosh Baruch Hu, pour thy wrath on people like Pharaoh, because that's the way redemption is going to happen. I think it's a reminder. And then
he says,
we say today, Hashem, as well, please find those people who've plotted, those people who've killed, those people who've maimed throughout the history, and take care of them as we approach our redemption. As we bring in Eliyahu, remember that moment. But it's interesting that the paradigm of this is ultimately Paro, and we saw it did happen to Paro, which is just a very interesting insight on a parshanut level, which I think is very, very worthy. Last idea, and we'll close with this, and that is the dipping. I think we're all familiar with this, and this is just a framework. We're all familiar with this, but it's so powerful to put the pieces together. You notice that the Haggadah starts and ends with dipping, right? Meaning Karpas is the beginning, and then Maros at the end. That's really the Maggid is sandwiched between two sets of dipping. But it's interesting that if you look at all of Redemption, all of the whole Yetzias Mitzrayim episode, it was also bracketed by dippings. Now, we know the different pieces, but who puts them together? The first dipping was, where did the whole thing is by Yosef, right? And we talked a few years ago, we learned together the relevance of Yosef and the connection to Yetzias Mitzrayim. But just for a brief moment, how was it that we went down to Mitzrayim? Well, it started with a fight between brothers, selling a brother down the river, and dipping his coat in blood to show the poor father, Yaakov, you know, that he died. That's how it started. When did it end? Which was the moment of freedom? It was ultimately where we also dipped blood. We took the blood of the Paschal lamb, we dipped the azov, this hyssop into it, and we painted it onto the doorpost. Think about that for a second. It started and ended with dipping. I say it starts and ends with dipping in the same way. What a brilliant insight. But then he takes it one step further. This is just a very interesting thought. He says the following. The two dippings, this is Rabbi Jonathan Sacks in his Haggadah, which of course should be on everybody's shelf and heart, which is different editions come out, but it's really, really worth it. This is actually to be found in the Haggadah portion, not in the essay portion. Most people go to the essays and read them before Pesach. It's worth just seeing some of the Pirushim on the bottom of the page as well.
He says, the two dippings recall these events. The karpas itself sweet. Now, I'm not sure if that means to say that he prefers potato. Okay, but nonetheless, the karpas itself sweet is dipped in salt and becomes sour. The maror itself bitter is dipped in the sweet charoises and has some of the bitterness removed. Isn't that interesting? So like there's a movement in the opposite direction of these two dippings. These two acts remind us that freedom which is sweet becomes sour when we use it to mistreat others. When freedom of expression turns into hate speech, when freedom of action turns into curtailing and hurting others, that's when that loses it. It's soaked in the bitterness. Slavery, which is bitter, is sweetened when collective suffering becomes human solidarity, and thus a prelude to freedom. So the same bitterness can be dipped into sweetness and transformed, and that's the movement of the Seder, from dipping one to dipping two. In the meantime, God willing, Mitzvah Hashem, all of these ideas should be something which we not just learn about, think about, repeat, but live, God willing, as we move towards our Geula, Lashon Hava, Yerushalayim. Thank you very much.